podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to a bonus episode of the Attacking Scrum podcast. This one is all about Rugby Mavericks, and who better to speak to about Rugby Mavericks than the author of Rugby's Greatest Mavericks, Mr. Luke Upton. So I caught up with Luke earlier on this week, massive Welsh rugby fan, written a couple of books before, which you may well have come across, and really great to have a chat with him about all things Maverick. Anyone who's listened to the podcast at any point over the last 6 years will know I love a flair player, but it's not just flair players we talk about. We talk about some of those Mavericks off the pitch as well, and kind of what the future is for those kind of players. So yes, absolutely great book. I really genuinely enjoyed it. So if you get an opportunity, head on to all good bookstores or even the bad big online one that we all know, and get yourself a copy just in time for Christmas as well. So that's it from me. If you enjoy this episode, then please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your pods. And don't forget, as always, you can follow us on social media at Attacking Scrum. To be honest, Twitter's the only one that I really use these days. So that's the best place to get hold of us. And while you're on there, you might well have an opportunity to win a copy of the book as well. We'll be running a competition there from Friday onwards, and there's a chance to win some copies of the book. So, be sure to check that out as well. But in the meantime, sit back, relax, and enjoy this chat with Luke Upton.
Liner steps inside, swallowed by the All Blacks. Bar Jones, Campisi, David Campisi all the way! A great try from the leading try scorer in world rugby, David Campisi, came across.
Welcome to a special episode of the Attacking Scrum podcast. Really, really excited about this one, and I'm delighted to say I am joined by Luke Upton, the author of Rugby's Greatest Mavericks. How are you doing, Luke?
Yeah, very good. Thanks for getting me on the show, Jed. First time, a long time listener, first time guest.
Those long time listeners are few and far between, so it's as much an honour for me as it is for you, Luke. Thanks for joining us. I'm not contractually bound to say this at all. I really enjoyed the book. It was an absolutely fantastic read. So thank you for sending the copy in advance. The pages just flew by. I suppose my first question is what attracted you to the concept of writing about rugby's greatest Mavericks in the first place?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I'm a big rugby fan, sort of lifelong rugby fan. And my first job was selling lottery tickets down at St. Helens in the glory days before regional rugby. So when you could see, Scott Gibbs and Mark Taylor and Colin Jarvis and the like playing. So, always been into rugby. And then started writing a couple of books a few years ago. Me and a friend started a very silly Gavin Henson parody account about 10 years ago now, called, I think we changed the name a few times for various reasons, shall we say, we ran as a Gavin Henson parody account, which recently just changed actually to Scrum Dingers. If anyone's wondering what that weird account is in their timeline, Gavin Henson is now running an excellent sort of vegan-friendly gastropub in the Vale of Glamorgan, so he's no longer a rich seam of content for a parody account. Ran that sort of business, sort of journalist, business media by training, and then a couple of years ago wrote another silly thing called Absolutely Huge, which was a sort of spoof autobiography of a player who was in no way like Gavin Henson for legal reasons, and then a couple of years later Al Oliver, who published that, said, would you be interested in writing a book about hard men of world rugby, which I did, and that sort of did all right. And then I guess so about 2 years ago, I wasn't really thinking of doing a sequel to it or anything, but I've always liked the characters of the game. I've always liked the stories, not really into stats or data or anything like that, I like the people in it. And then I was watching the Chicago Bulls documentary on Netflix, Last Dance, and obviously loads of people watched it. It was on during COVID, so I would never have watched a basketball documentary normally, but obviously didn't have anything else to do, so I watched that, and I absolutely loved it. And I seeing how sort of Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen and all the different guys in it all were so different, were kind of came together, and how well they were managed and everything, just got me thinking a bit about sort of rugby mavericks and how they they often aren't managed that well, and have a lot of them sort of burnout and that kind of thing. And yeah, it sort of led me to the idea for the book, and spoke to Alolva, and then they thought it was an all right idea, and then about 18 months later, here we are, 20 mavericks from around the world from the last sort of 80-90 years.
Yeah, and it's a real interesting mix that you've got in there as well. So there's perhaps some players you would expect to feature, the David Campeses of this world, and then other stories, people like Non Evans and Manny Cunningham, who perhaps wouldn't be the first that spring to mind. How did you go about kind of choosing the 20?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. There's no science behind it. There's no algorithm or anything like that. I was just looking for great stories, really, and very grateful that Alolva, great Welsh publisher, gave me the sort of freedom to look into stories, make a long list, and then choose 20 from there. So, what I was looking for was people who've sort of gone their own way in rugby, they're sort of free spirits. And yeah, some of them are players who are sort of, known for their flair. So, I mean, David Campese, obviously a big character off the pitch, but, a flair player. And, I guess Finn Russell, kind of similar, but, is known for his on the pitch. Serevi from Fiji, again, sort of an attacking player. But then I also looked at other players who were sort of really interesting off it. So, Jean-Pierre Reeve, who was, not a flair player, an incredibly talented, combative figure, but is also now a sort of world-renowned artist and has written books about art and rugby, and is a sort of really interesting character there. People like, Christophe Dominici, who was, again, sort of a flair player, but had his sort of, things off the pitch. And then, bringing it right through to people who, I guess, players who maybe are a little less known. Heather Moyes, who is a Canadian player. She's sort of, a fantastic player for Canada. I think she's their all-time leading try scorer. But she also won two gold medals at Winter Olympics, and she basically bounced between being a gold medal Olympian and being a great rugby player. And I spoke to her, and it's fascinating to hear how she managed all those things. And then someone like Marnie Cunningham, who a lot of people wouldn't have heard of, but he was as a player, he kind of had quite a good career, but a very short career. He sort of packed it in, an Irish guy in the 1950s, who packed it in to become a priest. All of a sudden, a surprise for everyone, became a priest. But then what was interesting about him was that he returned to Munster. He was a Munster boy, played for Cork and Munster and Ireland, and protested at an anti-apartheid protester at a Munster South Africa game. So he was outside the ground and people were recognising him as a, as an old boy of the club there in his Catholic priest's garb. And I thought he was just fascinating. Again, I spoke to his nephew and got a full story about him, about why he did what he did and everything. So yeah, really lucky to have to be able to sort of choose great stories, and it was a real privilege to sort of to jump into sort of 20 people's lives and learn a little bit about the world that they were in, and what drove them, and what they achieved, and I guess sometimes what they didn't achieve.
Yeah, those stories are fascinating, actually. And I looked at the 20 on the on the index as I opened the book and thought, I know I'm going to enjoy reading about Serevi and Campese. And it was those stories actually that kind of the people like Marnie Cunningham that kind of really that really drew me in. And I think one thing that's interesting, and you've touched on it there, is it isn't just about being a maverick on the pitch. This isn't just the 20 best flair players. It's about so much more than that. And I found the kind of the political angle there was really interesting. So not just Marnie Cunningham, but someone like David Pocock as well. particularly at this point in time. You know, we've got a World Cup in Qatar less than a week away in football, and various other things going on in the world. I was kind of keen to get your take. You know, how closely do you, or how intertwined do you think that sport and politics are in this day and age?
I think it's a good question. I think for a lot of rugby players, or just athletes in general, I think they just keep them separate. You know, I think they just don't get involved. I think the Qatar World Cup is obviously going on in a week or so, but will probably pass largely without incident. So I think it takes a particular type of player to get involved in politics, because you know that you're opening up yourself to, you know, an extra layer of abuse and grief and stress. I mean, David Pocock, again, you know, he's you know, hell of a player, not a flair player, you know, incredibly hard tackling, defensive, martial. But throughout his career, from a very young age, he sort of fostered a career of, sort of, social activism. So he's, you know, he chained himself to some building machinery that was trying to destroy an Aboriginal burial ground to build a big mine. He supported same-sex marriage. Didn't get married to his now wife until Australia gave legal equality, and kind of various other things. And he's done this in parallel to his career, and he has got grief for it. I mean, he's a popular figure in Australia. He's just been elected a senator at the age of like 33, 34. But there is an element of, you know, he's a bit of a windbag or a bit self-righteous, because he's choosing these things. He's had that criticism, and then there's criticism that he's a hypocrite as well, because he's a kind of a climate activist, but he was, you know, wore a shirt with Qantas on the front, and has traveled around the world to do speeches and things like that. So, you know, like anyone, I think, who puts a head above the parapet, they open up to a lot of criticism. But yeah, I've got a lot of respect for him. He's a hell of a player, and he's, you know, he's made difficult choices to do what he does. And I think it's really exciting to think what he does next, because he's only, you know, early 30s, he's a household name, he's a senator now, and, well, the world is oyster, I think.
I know, and it's so funny to think of that, isn't it? Because I remember, what would this have been, 2009, 2010, playing Australia in Cardiff, and just, it was one of the rare occasions where they didn't beat us by a point, which is why I think it stands out. But the other thing that stood out that day was, it was just, you know, it was one of his very early caps, and he was just clamped to the ball the whole day. Every time Wales took the ball into contact, it's either a penalty or a turnover, and Pocock was at the heart of it. And you just think at that point in time, it's like, oh God, the Aussies have unearthed another talent. You know, knowing nothing about him as an individual, and then, like you say, you fast forward 10, 12 years, and he's a senator. Is that the right?
He's a senator.
Getting confused myself here with the various elections around the world. But yeah, it's fascinating to see those. And those stories I found really interesting.
I think with his early life is interesting as well, because I knew he was from, you know, Zimbabwe, but you know, his family had a farm there, and they were, well, they had to flee effectively when Mugabe did his sort of disastrous, you know, land changes about 20 years ago. So they had neighbours who were killed and that kind of thing. So he sort of came to Australia as a, you know, as an immigrant, as a refugee. And yeah, so he's got, you know, in his interesting start to his life, and then, you know, started playing rugby. And I think within about 5 years of arriving in Australia, I think he was, you know, he was playing for the country. But yeah, really interesting guy. And yeah, off the field activism, in quite a stark contrast to incredible focus and discipline and, you know, tough as teak on the pitch. But yeah, I like him a lot. I did try and speak to him, but he was campaigning for a Senate election. So speaking to some Welsh guy wasn't a priority for him, which is probably fair enough.
That's it. Maybe we'll get a quote for the second edition when that comes up. And also, as well, what I found really interesting was a lot of the choices in there, you know, very complex characters as well. Did you get the impression that, like, a Di Bishop or a James Small or a Non Evans, that they kind of needed the rugby field as an outlet to kind of express themselves?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, yeah, a lot of them, I think like anyone or anything, when you start looking at it in detail, it becomes a lot more, you know, a lot more complex. But yeah, for a lot of them, rugby, you know, I wouldn't say saved, but I certainly think that it gave them an outlet. I mean, James Small was an angry young man. And rugby was a sort of a channel for him. You know, Non Evans, who I interviewed, and, you know, she was great, was, you know, not exactly hyperactive, probably isn't quite the right word, but, you know, a child who was just on the go all the time, doing loads of different sports and everything. And, you know, rugby was an outlet for her. I think that there is a sort of mental health aspect as well that runs through quite a lot of the selection. I mean, Christophe Dominici, obviously, you know, committed suicide a few years ago, and, you know, he struggled with sort of mental health all his life, and for him rugby was a release and a purpose. And when that was gone, and he was let down very badly by a few people after in his retirement. So for him, it was an outlet. I think, you know, Ray Gravel as well, someone that will be, you know, hugely familiar to every single person listening to this pod, you know, beloved figure, and, you know, a big part of my sort of childhood on, you know, BBC and Espederec and everything. And, you know, but I didn't really realize that he had a tough childhood. His father had also, you know, committed suicide when he was young, and, you know, the young Ray Gravel found the body. And it's, you know, it's tough to sort of read this even, you know, coldly, sort of 40, 50 years on. And speaking to someone at the book launch, actually, who was sort of broadly speaking the same age as Ray Gravel, and I had no idea that he'd had that sort of trauma as a youngster. And then how he was always quite unsure as a player as well. Like, I spoke to Steve Fenwick, obviously a great partner with him, and a really good chat with him about Gravel, and, you know, 500 odd games for Cletley and the Lions and Wales and everything. But before every game, he still doubted himself, and he needed a bit of G'ing up, and, you know, and it's sort of interesting to think someone who seemed to be the most confident man in the world still, you know, had his things. But yeah, I mean, everyone loves Ray Gravel, and it's funny, everyone I've spoken to about the Ray Gravel chapter, I said, oh, I've got a Ray Gravel story. I met him in, and you name it, you know, like, so he did something that he was in a car park in some way, he's talking to someone, you know, such a beloved figure. And I do wish I'd been able to, you know, to have interviewed him for it, because that would have been a very fun hour, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely no doubt about that. I was going to ask you as well, kind of, you obviously, as I've said there, you go into all different kinds of territory, and was there kind of one that you enjoyed writing about the most? Not necessarily, you know, as a player, but when you were writing those chapters, was there one that you kind of, really enjoyed doing?
I mean, I think that, yeah, I like the Gravel one was good. You know, he's such a fun figure to write about, and you know, you bring in a bit of sort of Welsh culture in the sort of 60s and 70s and things. I think the Marnie Cunningham, the priest, the player turned priest, I think it was great, because that's a story that's not really been told before. So I spoke to his family in Ireland, and, you know, that story is now sort of out there. I found the James Small chapter kind of really, you know, really interesting. I think that era is particularly interesting. I mean, you know, he came in one of the first wave of sort of post-apartheid players, basically played in the first couple of games where they were allowed to play internationally again. But again, the sort of the complexities that come in there, because he was coming out of the apartheid era, but he was from a British heritage, not a Dutch heritage, or Afrikaans heritage, I should say. So he had those sort of contentions there. And even though he's a bit of a bad boy, you know, he really connected with the other African culture that came into the game after the end of apartheid. And, you know, I thought he was really fascinating. And, you know, he had his bad times, he did some bad stuff as well, and, you know, that's in the chapter as well. It's on record that he had problems with drink and drugs and with partners. But I spoke to Joel Stransky for that chapter, and he spoke, you know, quite honestly about him, because he wasn't an angel, you know, but he was a wonderful player. And it's just, I think, a really interesting era to write about. And also one I had to be very mindful of. I took an awful lot of time on that chapter, because when you're writing about the challenging politics of a country that isn't yours, you know, you've got to be pretty careful. Because you know what it's like when people write cringy stuff about Wales, you know, you spotted a mile off, can't you? So I think those three, I think, were really interesting. But it was a privilege to sort of cover, you know, to cover such a variety in there. But I'd probably choose those three if I had to choose. But if you ask me tomorrow, I might pick a couple of different ones.
Yeah, and I think you handle the political stuff really, really well. It's superbly written. To bring it back to some of the on the pitch matters now, because you know, for all the depth and complexity in there, there's lots of fun kind of on the field exploits as well. One you mentioned there, obviously still playing today, played only yesterday, and that's Finn Russell. I was going to ask you about players like Finn Russell. Do you feel it's harder in this day and age, in an era where everything is kind of analysed to death? There's so much more data and things like that. It's so much harder to kind of be in that maverick mould. Or do you actually think that some coaches should take more of a risk and factor that into a side?
Yeah, I mean, Finn Russell is a special, you know, a special case. And I lost quite a lot of time on YouTube just looking at Finn Russell tries. You know, I mean, that's YouTube for this kind of book is an amazing resource, but it doesn't half suck the time away, because you just start looking up things and you're finding it. And there's some brilliant, brilliant moments from Finn Russell. I really, really enjoy watching him. I mean, he's quite interesting because he's not come from a usual. He's not maybe come through the usual sort of system because, you know, he was a sort of trainee stonemason for a couple of years. You know, he had a normal job. You know, he played on the weekends with the boys kind of thing. And then he sort of stepped it up a bit and went out to New Zealand and then got a sort of development contract and sort of went that way. So he's, you know, he hasn't always been primed for superstardom like some players are. And then obviously things like with his dad, his dad's kind of quite public bust up with the Scottish Rugby Football Union. You know, if I was playing for someone who'd quite publicly, quite brutally sacked my dad, I probably wouldn't feel quite as sort of connected. But yeah, I think he's a bit of an endangered species. And I think he's obviously very confident on the pitch and off the pitch. But I think there's players who probably have that confidence, but they just decide, you know what, it's not worth the hassle. Mm. You know, if you start talking on social media about politics, if you're a rugby player or social issues, you know, your timeline would blow up probably. You know, you'd be known as, you know, the left wing or right wing player or whatever. And you'd probably be very heavily advised against it by your club and your country. So I think there's probably still quite a few maverick spirits out there, but I think a lot of them just decide it's, you know, it's probably not worth the bother. I mean, I was watching a video earlier on of Joe Marler, and, you know, I mean, he is, I suppose, a sort of a maverick.
Oh, I think he is, really, yeah.
You know, and there's not many like him. I mean, he's, you know, he is what he is. He's certainly different. He's obviously got the confidence to be different. And that's working for him as well, I think, because he does stand out from the crowd. But yeah, I think a lot of players, I think because of the fairly conservative rugby system that people come through now, just get their head down and just try and keep earning the money, keep ticking along like a normal job for some of them, I think.
Particularly when it comes to the on-the-pitch stuff, it does make me a little bit concerned that, you know, your next book is going to be Rugby's Greatest Box Kickers or something like that. It's like, you know, it's a great game for people of all shapes and sizes and, you know, all those kind of rugby cliches. But at the same time, you know, I do worry sometimes about the entertainment of rugby, you know, and perhaps the overcoaching and things like that. I don't know if that's just, nostalgia and stuff like that, or perhaps that there is a problem on those things. What do you think, kind of, with regards to, you know, rugby as a source of entertainment in a world that's full of entertainment?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it is challenging, and I think it's obviously, as all the Welsh listeners to this pod will know, you know, there's obviously a big debate at the moment about the WIU and, you know, how it's run, and the match day experience at the Millennium Stadium, Principality Stadium, especially then in contrast.
Call it the Millennium.
Yeah, I'd never call it the Principality, I don't think.
Big check from Principality for me to do that, I think.
Yeah. And then, you know, comparing it to the football side. And I think, you know, I think that discussion is quite interesting, and I think there's a merit to it, but I also think it's quite a destructive discussion in Wales when you've actually got two pretty good teams and some people seem quite happy to sort of snipe against each other. But in terms of entertainment, yeah, I think it's a challenge. You know, you think of the players that, you know, we were kids, it tended to be, you know, players with that bit of personality and with a bit of flair. And I think if they're not around in the game, I think that does present some problems. I spoke to David Campese for his chapter, and he very kindly wrote the foreword, and he was, you know, exactly how you'd imagine he would be, you know, very forthright, and he's definitely concerned, and particularly from the Australia, with his Australian hat on, where there's Aussie rules, there's rugby league, you know, there's soccer, cricket, union and basketball, that, you know, kids are being sort of squeezed out by it. It's, you know, it's a product like any other. But on the other hand, I don't think, you know, I think you need to keep a lot of what's unique in rugby. You know, I don't think, for example, the Welsh Rugby Union should just cut and paste the Football Association experience and apply it to the Millennium, because I don't think that would work either, you know. So it's a challenge, but I think too many people in rugby, and I say this as a Welsh fan, but I think you can see it in quite a bit of countries, have been resting on laurels and have been, you know, coasting on, you know, the players of old or the teams of old and the reputation of old, and not looking forward enough. And I think we see a little bit of that in the book as well. Yeah.
Yeah. It's slightly off topic, but you're absolutely right, because I think you've touched on some really interesting stuff there. Copy and pasting the football experience for me simply wouldn't work. The reason it works so well for football, and you know, cast your mind back not that long ago, and the football, you know, was arguably a bit of a laughing stock. I think we all remember the losing to Leighton Orient and all those bizarre things. Like Welsh football was something of an oddity, wasn't it? Like French cricket or something, and that's mad, you know, for a country that's produced some of the greatest players the world has ever seen. But what I think what they've done so well is they have embraced a vision of Welshness and got hold of it and said, this is what we stand for as a football team. And, you know, these are the elements of the nation that we're really going to embrace, and it's going to feed into the match day territory. And they've done an incredible job. You know, there are some pretty big divisions within Welsh football. You know, that you will know very well that, you know, the Swansea Cardiff rivalry and how that's manifested itself at Welsh football games in many years ago. They've done a fantastic job of that, and the reason they've done it is because it's real and authentic. It's not, oh right, well, you know, we saw this, you know, we saw this that the French did, and we saw this that someone else did. It's a really clear, committed vision, and that's what for me Welsh Rugby Union has to get to the bottom of, is look, what do we stand for as a sporting body? How do we want that to be reflected in the match day experience? And, you know, you'll have heard Murph moaning at paying 130 quid a ticket to have Mr. Brightside blared out at him, when you can't hear the tributes to Phil Bennett and Eddie Butler, people who've made massive contributions to Welsh rugby. And I think that's there's no quick answer to it, but I think they're going to have to find that sooner rather than later.
Yeah, and I think, you know, to go back to sort of the maverick spirit, is that I think Welsh rugby hasn't always been a supporter of, you know, of your big personalities. It doesn't always like them, I think. I think sometimes they emerge, but they tend to come from overseas. I mean, you know, Warren Gatland, who was obviously on the show a few weeks ago, is one. I think Graham Henry would be another. But, you know, talking about Gravel earlier on. I mean, you know, Carwin, you know, never coaching Wales was a great example of that. And I think, and the, you know, the vote to the WIU board, what, 2 weeks ago or so, is the same kind of acceptance of, okay, we don't really want anyone to rock the boat too much. And I think, yeah, I think that's a problem for Welsh rugby, and I think it needs to, you know, it needs to look quite closely at that and wonder why. Because we've got the players, you know, we've always got a decent pool of players in Wales, but have we got the actual sort of personalities and leadership to actually make them do something? I'm not too sure we have at the moment.
Let's talk about one more player who certainly rocked the boat when it came to Welsh rugby and is a character that I am absolutely fascinated by, and that's Mr. David Bishop. again, just, you know, I particularly enjoyed that chapter. What do you make of the whole Di Bishop story?
Yeah, and again, you know, talking to people in South Wales, you know, people have opinions on him. People have their own stories on him, mm-hmm. as well, which aren't in the book. But yeah, I mean, a wonderful player. I think I write kind of at length about it in the chapter, but the game against Swansea where he, you know, he slots those kicks from miles out in the rain is such a, you know, a wonderful clip on YouTube where, you know, it's still industrial South Wales. It's, you know, it's still moustaches and, you know, long extinct beers being advertised, and the pitch is awful and there's some terrible fouls, but nothing's given. And then he, you know, he slots his kick and then he wiggles his arse in front of the selectors, you know, and it's a brilliant moment, you know. And then, but yeah, you know, again, absolutely, you know, fascinating character, very complex, again, you know, complex sort of life, you know, it rugby did sort of offer him a guidance, and, you know, Mr. Prosser at Pontypool obviously sort of has shaped him a lot. I think it's interesting of him, what would have happened if he'd been born, well, 20 years later, I suppose, you know, if he'd come through as a professional. I don't know is the answer to that. I mean, he had the skills, without a doubt, to be wonderful, but he was always marked. He was always a marked man. And I think to go back to what we were just saying about the Welsh establishment not liking the people who are going to rock the boat, he was very clear he was going to rock it. Mm. So,
well, what I think is fascinating about that question as well, you know, William made it 20 years later, is, you know, my gut instinct to that is he was just so talented he would have. And I say that having never seen him play rugby. I vaguely remember a few games of rugby league watching him play, but he was pretty, you know, kind of.
Yeah.
I know he retired in the 90s, didn't he? But it, you know, I don't remember any of that. And all the folklore is the stuff from the 80s. And in a way, that's what's brilliant about it, is it's mm-hmm. the myth and the legend, and you're going on what people told you, because it's an era. You know, you can't go back and live stream Pontypool versus Treorchy from the early 90s on Premier Sports. You know, it's all there, all the myth around it. In a way, I just think kind of adds to the romance. And in a way, it doesn't matter whether he would have made it or not. I'm fully bought into the cult that he would have.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, the stories are great. Him rescuing the mother who'd slipped into the swollen taff with the pram with a buggy in, and him getting in and getting her out, and then getting awarded his medal while he was on remand. I think the prison governor giving him like the Queen's Medal for bravery or something. I mean, you know, you sort of couldn't make it up. But yeah, you know, a brilliant player. You know, great fun writing it. But again, another sort of quite complex sort of character. It's funny, like I interviewed quite a lot of old players for this book, and it's always great to have a chat about, you know, their career or the career of a teammate if the teammate sort of passed away. And I always say, like, as a final question, so would you like to have played today if you'd been born 20, 30, 40 years later? And they pretty much all say no. Mm. Because, I mean, the fun factor, as they always talk about, you know, the tours, you know, speaking of Donal Lanahan and, you know, Steve Fenwick and people like that, about the tours sounded great, you know, great fun with the journalists out with them, you know, no social media, no photos. So those are great fun. And then the injuries aspect as well. You know, a few of them have said, I wouldn't you know, I've got aches, you know, I've got aches and pains now, but I played for 20 years. I'm 67 now. Mm. I'm all right. But wouldn't be, you know, wouldn't be now. So no, I don't think any of them said, I think David Campese said, I'd still be bloody good. That's what he said to me if he was playing there, which, you know, he would be.
Do you know what? That's one that you don't need to piece together. Having watched enough of him, he simply would have been, because I think he, you know, for all of the swagger and bravado, he strikes me, and I may be making this up, but he strikes me as someone who would have been able to embrace modern training methods if he thought it made him better, you know, and it would have. And I think he would have just had that raw instinct and self-belief and flair to thrive in a, you know, in the modern era.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He was a big trainer. You know, he was ahead of the game on that. He wasn't a drinker as well. Quite a big drinking culture back then, and he wasn't, you know, wasn't into that. So, yeah, and I think the myth, you know, the myth of some of these guys. We've got Moss Keane in there as well, so Irish player from the 80s, and he's, you know, he's quite interesting because he played GAA and played Union. That's maybe something for another podcast. But you know, his reputation was of being like a big pints man, you know, and being out on the lash all the time. And I think when he, like a lot of these boys, when he, you know, when he got stuck into the pub, you know, there would be quite a few pints and it would be a big night. But the idea that these boys are having, you know, 10 pints a night in the 70s and 80s, this isn't true. They're doing 5 mile runs before work and stuff like that. You know, even in the amateur era in the 80s, when things were still pretty loose. Yeah. Still very, very, you know, still very, very committed. But yeah, you know, it's a fascinating to think how these boys would be now. I'd love to see it, you know, I'd love to see it, but we never will.
Well, talking of things I'd love to see, but we never will. The Andy Ripley chapter, I found really, really entertaining, and actually not a player I knew a huge amount about. Superstars had clearly passed me by, because again, I fell into that trap of just thinking about Kevin Keegan falling off his bike. So I had no idea he had been a kind of household name through Superstars. What I would love to get your take on, Luke, and I'm putting you on the spot slightly. Mm-hmm. If we were able to commission a rugby version of Superstars today, who do you think would be the stars, and kind of what disciplines would they succeed at?
So for our listeners who don't know what Superstars is, it was a show that was in the sort of late 70s, early 80s, and got a bit of a reboot about 15 years ago,
yeah,
I think.
I remember the reboot in the early noughties, yeah.
Sort of sportsmen from different disciplines competed against each other. So you'd have, like, you know, an athlete, a footballer, a skier, rugby player, and they'd all be competing against each other in like running and other things like that. I reckon Luke Charteris would be good at basketball.
Great shout that, yeah.
I reckon if we're going sort of like middle distance, like running all day, I go for someone like Tipperick. Mm-hmm. I reckon at a pace, but I think just keeps going.
I'd like to see Josh Navidi embrace his father's wrestling skills, because there is something about that man that just has pure, like, kind of inherited strength. Do you know what I mean? For a guy who, yeah, of course, you know, he works incredibly hard at his physique, but there is something there that is natural ox-like strength. And I think any kind of like wrestling type discipline, he would be fantastic at.
Yeah, like Tyson Fury, sort of generation after generation of boxer. There's a bit of it you just can't vouch for. I think it would be great to bring it back. I think the players, you know, get the insurance, and the players would embrace it. I don't know about cycling. You have to be looking at scrum half or something for cycling, wouldn't you? And you're Thomas Williams or someone like Rob Howley in the day.
Yeah, that's a good shout.
Would have been good at cycling, I reckon.
Thomas, again, is a keen basketball player, isn't he, I believe?
As
was Richie Collins. Chuck him and Charteris into the mix. You know, we could have ourselves a fictional Welsh rugby equivalent of the Chicago Bulls here, I reckon.
Without any evidence, I feel like Ken Owens would be good at darts. You know, I mean, he should be as a hooker, but he's got the look about him, isn't he? That he'd just be, he'd be good at darts. I reckon
he would work as a darts character, wouldn't he? You know, he's got the nickname, the Sheriff, as well. You know, that would be absolutely magnificent.
And he's a young man called Ken. as well, which there aren't many of them around, are there? But I tell you what, we talked about WOU getting a lot of criticism, but I actually think their social media videos have actually gotten a bit better recently. Yeah. So maybe they could do a sort of a Superstars style show and we can get a bit of credit for it.
Hey, look, I pay 130 quid a ticket to watch that. Mark my words, I'll be. You can pump all the Mr. Brightside you like at me, and I'll be on board with that. Look, it's been fantastic chatting to you. As I say, I really, really enjoyed the book. Just for our listeners who haven't got a copy yet, obviously Christmas is around the corner. Where can you get hold of the book?
Yeah, I mean, thanks for having me on. Yeah, really, really enjoyed talking about it, and you know, hope everyone listening has got a sort of a little bit of a flavour of it. Available in wherever you get your books, basically. So, independent bookshops will order it for you if they don't have it on the shelves. Waterstones, Smiths, Foyles, the large online retailer, the world's largest online retailer, also has it. So it's on there as well. Wherever you get your books, shout out to Cover to Cover in Mumbles, which some of you will know, had the book launch there a couple of weeks ago. Great bookshop, like independent bookshop, family run place. So if you're in sort of Mumbles, Swansea way, pop in there so they can have a copy. But yeah, everywhere you get your books. And I think we'll do a little competition for the listeners, yeah, as well.
We absolutely will. Yeah, Luke's very kindly given us some copies to give away. So keep your eyes on social media later this week, and we'll be running a competition. Really, really straightforward, where you just retweet and tell us your favourite rugby mavericks. And this will be some good crowdsourcing for the sequel.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's really, really good fun to write, and you know, appreciate everyone who's sort of supported us on it, and all the rugby players who've actually replied to like a tweet or a LinkedIn message or an email from just some random guy, and they've actually given up some time to speak to me. It's been a pleasure. So yeah, hopefully you guys will enjoy it as well. If you like your rugby on the characterful side, hopefully it'll be interesting for you.
It will, yeah. And as I say, with that sequel, we look forward to seeing Matthew Morgan, who was criminally overlooked for this edition for some reason, because it'd be too easy to write about the mercurial talents. Luke, thanks so much for joining us, and we'll be back to chat rugby with you very, very soon.
Podcast Network.